we've covered the basics, and this week we get to do applications. But I will start by a brief resume of what I did before and sort of the basic structures and relations that we need. Are there any questions before I start people might have thought of? Okay.
And a different question. So you give us one version of an action principle for speed dynamics, but I think you were hinting that there's another.
Yeah, I was actually going to use that one as part of the review, the second one.
Perfect.
Just in one moment. So let's say we talk about the electromagnetic field as being a two-form. So it's an anti-symmetric covariant tensor. It satisfies Maxwell's equations, which are that it's a closed two-form. And d star f is the current, star is the Hodge dual operator. F is a two-form, and in four dimensions, the dual of a two-form is another two-form. And then when you take the exterior derivative of that, that ups the rank one. So this whole thing is a three-form. So this is a current three-form. And I explained how it's a good idea to think about current as a three-form, but we could always dualize it by contracting with the contravariant four-index anti-symmetric volume element and turn it into a vector. And that would be the usual current density vector that we usually talk about. Now, because the key algebraic thing is that if there's a vector, so if there exists a vector W such that W is a null vector of F, you know, is a zero eigenvector of F. So F is degenerate in this sense, that it has some zero eigenvector. This is equivalent to saying that the two-form F wedge itself is zero. And that is equivalent to saying that the two-form F is actually a wedge product of two one-forms. And that's just algebra. But then if we also impose that F is a closed two-form, then we get that each of these two one-forms is the derivative of a scalar. So if we say plus df equals zero, that implies that F is d phi 1, wedge d phi 2. Phi 1 and phi 2 are two scalar functions. They're called the Euler potentials. And they're convenient for describing electromagnetic fields of this kind. And notice that this W could be any vector at this point. One way this comes about is if you have a conductor, a perfect conductor, and then the electric field vanishes in the rest frame of the conductor. So W would be the four velocity of the conductor. And then you would have that F is degenerate. A different way it might come up, well, let me write this down. So example one is a perfect conductor. Then we have U dot F equals zero, where this is the U is the four velocity of the conductor. That could be a conducting solid or a conducting liquid, like in magnetohydrodynamics. And the other example is force-free, which is that the current, that there's, bless you, there's no four force on the current, or that is, you know, physically, It's that we can get away with neglecting the force the fields exert on the current because the charges carry so little energy and momentum that it's negligible compared to the field energy and momentum. So we just set from the get-go the force to zero, and that closes the system of equations just on the field without having to track the dynamics of the particles. So that corresponds in tensor notation to saying FAB JB is zero. We could equally well write that, I guess, this way, but I'm hesitating because I don't want to use this letter J up there is the current three form. This is the current vector. So I guess I'll just use lowercase j here as the dual of that three form written as a vector. And in this case, there may not even be a well-defined rest frame of any of the plasma. And we showed that this condition, if you take into account that F is the wedge product of two one forms, this is actually equivalent to just saying that alpha wedge, the current is zero, and beta wedge, the current is zero. And this is the convenient form that we're going to use, and I'll derive it now from this action that Eric just mentioned. Right. So let's consider just the usual Maxwell action as F wedge dual F. That's a four form. It can be integrated on a four-dimensional space-time. I should say in this equation that what is it a function of? So I'm thinking here of F is a function of the vector potential. That would be the usual Maxwell action. Suppose we just add to that a constraint that just enforces this degeneracy condition, nothing else. We can do that with a Lagrange multiplier, which would be a scalar field. So let's consider that action. Now this becomes one of the fields, so I should include it in the action principle. And the lambda equation of motion imposes this degeneracy condition or simplicity constraint. And what happens when we vary A? Well, we get the usual D star F. Because the variation of F is the variation of dA, which is D of the variation of A. And then we integrate by parts the D that appears there. We get a similar contribution from the dual of F. And I guess that's it. And here, we actually, when we integrate by parts, we hit this star F, so we pick up a D star F. If we do it over here, we integrate by parts, we hit F, and DF is zero by definition, since F is DA. However, now we have the scalar field sitting here. So when we integrate by parts, we also hit lambda. And we don't have to go through a one form to get to it, so the sign is different. So we actually get D star F equals D lambda wedge F. So those are our equations of motion for this theory. But now this equation tells us, like I just said, that F is alpha wedge beta. So I could also write this one as D lambda wedge alpha wedge beta. And of course, this is the current. So this tells me if I wedge this with alpha, I get zero because alpha is one of the factors of it. This tells me that the current is a simple three form. That's the wedge product of alpha, beta, and d lambda. So this implies that alpha wedge d star f, or current, is 0, and also beta wedge current is 0, which is exactly these force-free equations. And conceptually, like, why is this working when we didn't say anything about force-free to begin with? We just said degenerate. And I said here that you could have degenerate fields, for instance, without it being force-free. Just as long as there's some vector W, such that WF is 0, you have a degenerate field. But what's different here is that there's nothing else in the action except for A. So we're saying that A satisfies, the equations of motion for A come from an action without being coupled to any other degrees of freedom. And somehow just saying that and the fact that F is degenerate gives us force-free, which totally makes sense because force-free is the statement. Another way to say this condition is to say that the divergence, I should probably say that, is equivalent to saying that the divergence of the electromagnetic stress tensor is 0 by itself. I think I have to also invoke df is 0 to show that this is equivalent to this. So it's just that the fields, you know, are a conservative system by themselves. Bianca, you're scrunching you're furrowing your brow, that's what they call it. Do you have a comment or a question?
So is there no coupling between F and G?
Is there no coupling?
I mean, so here, so you assume going from D star F equal to, that you assume that D star F is equal to J.
Yeah, I define it as J.
So it's a definition.
It's not a definition.
An equation of motion. It doesn't come as an equation.
Right, it comes as a definition. It reminds me so much of when I first learned general relativity and people said, why aren't Einstein's equations true by definition? Because you could define the stress tensor by the left-hand side of the equation, by the Einstein tensor. Then every metric satisfies the Einstein equation for some stress tensor, which happens to be equal to the Einstein tensor. And then, of course, the answer is, well, no, because you'd have to have some matter, some other degrees of freedom, which actually had that stress tensor and whose equations of motion were consistent with that equation. So here we're saying it's like the exact same thing. We're just defining the current by the right-hand side of Maxwell's equation. Normally, you shouldn't be able to do that. But somehow, when you add the degeneracy condition, the system closes, as I explained in detail the first time, I think, by itself. And I can't emphasize enough how shocking this was to me and how incomprehensible till I finally, you know, banged my head. I asked several people about it, too, who worked in the field before I understood it. I even asked Roger Blanford, ran into him at a conference, and I said, I'm trying to understand force-free electrodynamics. How can it possibly work? And he said something. Maybe I said this already. He said something. He probably said exactly the right thing, but I couldn't understand it. And I walked away feeling like he doesn't even understand it. But I'm sure he did, but I just didn't. So it's just weird.
He understood it his way.
Yeah.
So just a math question. So that J can be written as d lambda wedge alpha wedge beta. So I can see that this guarantees the force-free equations, but does it go back the other way too? So if J satisfies those two equations, does it guarantee that?
Actually, I was quite puzzled by that. It certainly guarantees these two equations do tell you that J is alpha wedge, beta wedge, gamma for some gamma. But I couldn't for the life of me show that gamma has to be of the form d lambda.
Right.
So I was quite puzzled by that. But then I finally realized, and I think this is true, that it doesn't, in a sense that gamma is only defined in this equation up to a linear combination of alpha and beta. So I think it does imply that gamma can always be chosen to be d lambda. See what I mean? Because this equation just doesn't determine gamma. I think that's what hung me up. But so if you work through it, I believe you can show that you can always choose gamma to be D of something. In fact, you just take D of this. So because J is, well, I should say, because D star F is J, then J is automatically closed. So we know that DJ is zero. And then, but this is F wedge gamma, so, and DF is closed, so we get that F wedge D gamma is zero. So D gamma may not be closed, but it has to be built of things that give zero when they're wedged with F. But that's exactly what alpha and beta do, because F is alpha wedge beta. So I think it works out like that. Maybe I should, to be complete, and gamma can be chosen equal to D lambda. But actually, I guess it's not, the logic requires not just these equations, but also that DF is zero. That D alpha wedge beta is zero. Okay, yeah.
How come there's no term like J dot A in the action?
That term would have led to the four force, which is exactly what we're setting to zero. That's the coupling. I mean, but let me not just be satisfied with that answer, because then you can say, but wait a minute. Okay, at least the four force, but it also tells you how the current sources the field.
Right.
So aren't you getting rid of everything at once by leaving it out? But no, because I'm defining the current as the right-hand side of the equation. Okay, so let's see.
I think that's where you get the analogy with Einstein's equations, right? Because you're using the matter model for whatever is producing the charges.
Yes.
So that becomes completely evacuated from the problem. And it's still self-consistent because there's enough structure in the force-free dynamics to guarantee that it's a self-consistent.
Yeah, but actually, this now raises a question that is really important that you never hear discussed, that Sam Grala and I have been thinking about in special cases, which is the word matter model. You could ask and should ask, fine, mathematically it closes, but does that mean that for every solution to these equations, there exists a matter model that could have given rise to that current? Could you ever have a solution to these equations in which, you know, no matter model could exist for some reason? And so we started working on that in terms of our current JET research, actually, which maybe I can get to later. But it turns out in the case we looked at, there's a huge amount of freedom in the matter model. You can do it in a certain approximation, but let me, which I think is the right approximation, but let me not digress on that right now. If I don't come back to it, remind me, please. At some point.
So when we did this whole thing, or like saying that this thing is conserved, the ENM stress tensor is conserved by itself, we were making some approximation where, like the I guess the matter doesn't affect the fields very much.
Not that it doesn't affect them in terms of its charge. Its charge certainly affects them, but its mass and momentum, its energy and momentum, are negligible.
Okay. I was just wondering like where that comes in, because that should break down if something gets big, right? If you actually want to know how force free breaks down, you mentioned that it breaks down generically. Like what, if we've eliminated the current from our description, or like what should we look for when the thing breaks down?
So how do we see it within the variables that remain, you mean?
Yeah.
I think, but I'm not sure, it might be that, or one place that might be is where the fields approach being null fields instead of magnetically dominated. Because the idea is that, now I'm being forced to mention the thing I was just not going to mention about what's happening with the matter. Okay, I better say it, I guess. So maybe it is the right time. So if the idea is the field's very strong, and basically let's say we're interested in the magnetically dominated case, because that's probably the only physically sensible, and it's also the only mathematically sensible case, I think. Maybe the null case as a limit of magnetically dominated is sensible. So if you have a super strong field and you have a charge, that charge is going to make little circles around field lines. And if it has translational motion, it makes spirals around field lines. But roughly speaking, the particles are stuck on field lines, which really means they're stuck on field sheets. I explained last time that because F has this form, the intersection of a surface of constant phi 1 and phi 2 is a two-dimensional surface in space-time of containing all the vectors that are in the kernel of F. We call those the field sheets. And they really are just histories of field lines followed in a frame in which the electric field is zero. But if the electric field is zero, then the only force on this particle is going to be the magnetic one that makes it circle around the field line in that frame. So the moral or the conclusion is matter is sort of sliding along the field sheets. And if a field sheet is, let's say in some fixed Lorentz frame, it's just a line in space cross time, then matter would just sort of scoot along that sheet and not be accelerated. But suppose the sheet starts to tip up towards the light cone. Then the matter has to move within the forward light cone on the field sheet. And the field sheet being two-dimensional, the light cone is a wedge on the field sheet. And as the field sheet becomes null, that wedge scissors together into, eventually when it's null, it becomes a single line, and that's just the light line. But that means that any matter that was on the field sheet is being accelerated to the speed of light. And then even if it has very little mass and have very little energy to begin with, it's going to have a lot of, energy eventually. If you take a particle of any mass and make it go at the speed of light, it'll have infinite energy. So eventually that would make the approximation break down. The problem is, I don't know how to characterize how close you are to being null just within these fields, because as long as it's not null, some observer sees it as strictly timelike. So you have to sort of follow the process. So for a specific example, you could imagine like an outflow of matter and the field sheets are becoming null. The matter is more and more accelerated as it goes out. You have a kind of reference to the original, let's say, rest frame of the center of spherical symmetry. And then you could definitely say this field is going to be accelerating the particles, sourcing it without limit. But that's only a beginning of an answer, and I feel like that's an obscure aspect of the subject that needs to be understood better, as far as I can see. Nobody ever talks about it, except in the sense I just said.
It also seems like a way to avoid that. It's just that there would be a tendency to avoid field sheets becoming null if the matter's there. Because if it becomes null, you get that these particles are being accelerated a lot, so you would think that they would tend to not want to be null,
Well, if you put the... So one thing that's done very commonly is you don't use force-free, you use ideal MHD. So then there's a fluid, and it has a mass density, and the acceleration of the fluid feeds into the equation. And you could have a regime where even though you're doing a fluid, it's really acting exactly like force-free, and then it transitions to, ideal MHD, where the inertia of the fluid is becoming important or even dominant. But you're asking me a good question. What if I'm just doing force free? Is there some way to see that I'm heading for a disaster, that the equations shouldn't be applied anymore? I don't know. I mean, if things remain smooth, but I'm going somewhere bad, I don't know. I hope to understand that better myself. Okay. So that was kind of review and a little more stuff. So what I want to do is mainly talk about monopole magnetospheres today. So hope, depending on how far we get, we'll talk about magnetospheres. And the main two examples will be this famous Michael monopole and the Blanford-Snayek solution for a spinning black hole. And then if we get farther, I'll also talk about current sheets and split monopoles. So I'm thinking probably we'll at least start this today. So to do this, I just want to start by reminding you about the monopole solution and the outgoing flux solution, and then how we put them together and we make the Michael monopole.
Are you going to say anything about field recombinations?
Field recombinations.
Reconnections. I never understood that.
Only a tiny bit when I talk about current sheets, but no. It's certainly not described in this approximation, but it would be a question of what happens to a current sheet that field reconnection comes in.
Sometimes they show up without current sheet.
Pardon?
Sometimes they can arise without current sheet in reconnection.
Oh.
Yeah, you have to see lines that are coming that way.
Do you know a configuration? For instance, in force-free, where that would come up?
Yeah, if you have two dipoles going around, so you see this. Imagine that you have, at least the case that we have, so it's just two dipoles that are just put in this way. So there they cannot do anything. But now, in this direction, they could recombine, or here like that. At some point, this one's only in that direction, right? Which is different from this case.
But are you saying that if you had such a configuration that was otherwise force-free, reconnection would lead to a breakdown of force-free?
Yeah.
Before so inertia was a problem?
Was it? Right, when it breaks, then there's a local violation of force-free condition.
Right.
And then it cures itself.
Oh, is there some way to put that event into a simulation where you allow for reconnection?
Yeah, so it happens all the time. We have done this kind of thing.
So you have a strictly force-free simulation, but there's a...
Well, this is strictly in the sense that it's, as you, that you know well, right? When it fails, then you allow it to fail. You do something there to just make it tame and then keep going. So you say that momentarily it breaks, but then from there on it works. It keeps working, right? It's just like what you do with current.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. So let me. So you're saying you can get to a null. You can get to a point where the magnetic field actually goes to zero. Let's say.
Well, no, sometimes so you have a field like this coming this way.
Yeah.
Then and now you're bringing say two dipoles close to each other. So depending on the equation, it may seem more convenient to just and not keep going in this direction, but connect with this other one and just go from one dipole to the other.
Right.
So you can this.
Right, but I'm just saying locally in the simulation, what's happening is that the field strength is getting very small, the magnetic field strength. Or in other words, that the field is becoming, it's not magnetically dominated anymore.
Yeah.
It may go null first. So it'll show up in the simulation by basically in some time step, magnitude of E will be greater than magnitude of B.
Yeah, I think that's
And then this would be electrically dominated. The equations are not, the initial value formulation isn't even well posed in the continuum for this. So what people do is they say that physically, if this were to happen, you could have reconnection. We're not going to simulate the reconnection, but what we'll do is simply chop E down, prune the electric field. So let's say here's your electric field in this time step at some point, and here's your magnetic field. We'll just chop off the E field, I call it pruning, until it's no longer electrically dominated, and then continue the evolution. So you just basically do something that's not in the equations at all. But physically, you would think somehow the physics you're leaving out, of course, would actually reduce the electric field by some complicated process. It might be pair creation and screening the electric field, or it might be reconnection, reconfiguring the fields locally. But then the question is, if you do that, do you actually get an evolution that corresponds in a coarse grained sense to what a reconnection event would give you? Have you ever thought about that, or does anybody?
I think the big guys have done that. I mean, compared with the coarse grained reconnections, and you say the fact that they keep using it, I guess you're saying that it makes sense, but I haven't looked at this either.
So, as I said at the very beginning of the course, I'm no expert on this and I'm new to the subject. So far, I've never seen a single paper discussing this point, you know, actually analyzing what would happen in a reconnection. Does this procedure give you a reasonable approximation?
So is that what you do in your simulation? You just truncate the E-field?
Yeah, because as we talked before, the moment E gets larger than B, then you don't have a system, the whole system of the question.
Right. But what's the physics story that you give in order to just
precisely what Ted said?
Okay. So you just wish for the best.
Is it well, that energy gets taken out of the system? You're creating particles, and then you keep going.
Actually, in terms of the word energy, I mean, it's not even clear to me at the level of energetics that process always dissipates energy. This ad hoc procedure of pruning E. I mean, clearly it does reduce the electric field energy density there. On the other hand, you introduce a rapid time derivative of E, which injects curl of B, so it changes the size of B. So I would think that a good thing to do would be to try to actually analyze the...
Well, you can monitor it, the total energy density, at least the local energy density.
Do you do that?
Yeah.
Oh, and what happens?
And it actually gets reduced.
It always reduces.
Always, in the case we looked at.
Yeah, okay. So let's see, that was a digression. But a good one. That came from you asking if I was going to talk about reconnection. Okay, so let me just remind you how the monopole worked and the outgoing flux, then we put them together and we get the Michael monopole. So the monopole field strength to form, can be written that way. And now let's do one of these sketchy calculations. It's, sketchy like not valid, just ignoring irrelevant factors and signs and so forth. So what's the dual of a two-form like that going to look like? Let's just do this in flat space. I guess I want to do it in Schwarzschild because we need it in Schwarzschild for the Blandford-Snyak solution. So let's do it in Schwarzschild. So the phi and theta directions are orthogonal to the t and r directions in Schwarzschild coordinates. So this is going to be proportional, the dual to proportional to dt wedge dr. You can also see, and this is actually important, crucial, that the sign, you're not going to have any theta dependence. And the way that you can think about that, I think I'll do this actually. Let's first rewrite this thing. Yeah, there's one intermediate step that I think is important. So let's write it in terms of unit one forms. So therefore, I should multiply d theta by r, and I should multiply d phi by r sine theta. I already have the sine theta, and that's crucial. So this is actually equal to q over r squared r d theta wedge r sine theta d phi. And these being unit one forms, which we get from the metric. So now when we dualize, we know we're not going to get any sine thetas. No theta dependence because we just have to find the orthogonal wedge product of two unit one forms, which is going to be a dt and a dr times some function of r in spherical symmetry that depends on the metric function gtt and grr. So therefore, we can say that the dual of the monopole field strength is going to go like some function of r dt wedge dr. Now, when we take to calculate the current, we just take the exterior derivative of this, and we get zero because df is just df dr times dr, and dr wedge dr is zero. So there's no current. So this is a vacuum solution. That's our demonstration that that's a vacuum solution. So, should I do it that way? Okay, and what about the outgoing flux solution? So, outgoing pointing flux. I said that had the form d psi wedge du. Where size of where u is the retarded time coordinate in Schwarzschild r minus t minus r star, and psi is an arbitrary function of theta phi and u, but not r. So let's how we check that this is a force-free solution. We take its dual. Now, because du is null, and d psi is going to have a d theta, d phi, and a du, the du part won't give you anything. D theta and d phi are orthogonal to du. Therefore, this is a null two-form. And its dual is just given by du wedge the orthogonal wedge the form that's orthogonal to d psi and orthogonal to du and has the same magnitude as d psi. So I could just write that it's going to be something that's a combination of d theta and d phi. So this will be a d theta plus b d phi wedge du, where a and b are functions of theta, phi, and u in general. And now if I calculate the current, I'll just have dA wedge the rest and dB, but that A and B are just functions of theta, phi, and u. So I'll just pick up here a d phi d theta du, and here maybe a d theta d phi du. Either way, I'm just going to get d phi d theta and du. And never any dr. That's the crucial thing. So now the force-free equations tell me I should wedge my two factors of the field with this current, see if I get zero. The two factors are d psi and du. If I wedge du with that, I get zero because it's got a du. And if I wedge d psi with it, I also get zero because d psi doesn't have any dr in it. So it just consists of these three forms. So it's just by inspection that this is a solution. So let's say, and du wedge j equals d psi wedge j equals zero. Check. So it's force free. Maybe I'll stop for questions about the technicality. Any question about that? Okay, actually, now we have a choice about whether to do the Kerr example first. I think maybe it's worth it, but it depends on what you're interested in. So we could go two ways. This doesn't work as is, but a small modification works in the Kerr background. You would think you would want to know that modification to figure out the solution for a spinning black hole to describe the outgoing flux, which is what the Blandford's Nyack solution is. And it would be great, the fact that we have an exact solution for Kerr makes you hope that you could actually write the analog of the Michael monopole for Kerr, but you can't. The reason is that we can superpose this outgoing flux solution with this monopole solution and get a solution for Schwarzschild, but not for Kerr. Even though we have a monopole for Kerr and a monopole and an outgoing flux for Kerr. So maybe I should focus on that point and not do the Kerr derivation right now, but it's in our paper. And if you want me to, I'm very happy to. I'm very proud of it, but it's not, like from a physics point of view, it's not the most important thing at this stage. So let's talk about superposition. So in usual E&M, you can superpose vacuum fields. Or if you have a field with one set of sources and another field with another set of sources, if you superpose the sources, you can superpose the corresponding fields. You know, a charge here and a charge here. We can't do that in force-free because the equation is nonlinear for the field. So in general, if you take two force-free solutions and you try to add them, you don't get a solution. So nonlinearity implies that we can't superpose force-free solutions in general. However, there's a special case that we're looking at right here where we can. However, we can superpose monopole plus outgoing flux in flat space or Schwarzschild. So let's say in Schwarzschild. So why can we do that? I'll explain it in a picture. Maybe I'll use this. So the outgoing flux, the monopole is strictly radial. B monopole. And the outgoing flux solution has a strictly radial null current. So J vector of the outgoing flux solution is also radial. Outgoing Now, the monopole doesn't contribute any current. So if we're asking, can we add them and have a force free? What we're really asking is the monopole part of the field still orthogonal to the current? Maybe I should write that in covariant equations. Like we have F outgoing AB JB is 0. The question is F outgoing plus F monopole with the same JB, because the monopole doesn't contribute any current because it's a vacuum solution. So this is the question. And that really just comes down to the question of whether the monopole field is orthogonal to the current. Now, the monopole field is just a radial magnetic field. So it only sees the vector part of this, the spatial vector. And the B field is actually parallel to J, which is exactly the condition for no force. In terms of a two form, B being parallel to J says that the two form for B is orthogonal to J. So indeed, you can just see by inspection in that sense it's true. We could also just check it in terms of our differential forms. We should be able to do it that way. see where I did that. Well, I think I won't. It's just a technicality to show. I was going to show it by following the using the general form of our force-free equations. What I'd have to do that is, having added the monopole to the outgoing flux, I have to figure out what alpha and beta are for that superposed solution and then check these conditions. That's straightforward to do. So let's not do that. Instead, let's get onto the physics of superposing them to describe this rotating star magnetosphere. That's the Michael monopole. So we want to consider a rotating conducting sphere. That's got a monopole charge on it. It's a rotating conducting monopole. And outside, we're going to use some flux solution superposed with that monopole. But we have to impose the conducting condition. So if it's rotating with angular velocity omega, the four velocity of a point on the surface of the conductor is, so u of the conductor is proportional to time translation plus omega d phi. In other words, we're just saying d phi dt is omega. At this point, omega could be a function of latitude. It could even be a function of time, as you'll see. But let's just don't worry about what it's a function of right now. So we want to impose the condition. Well, what do we want to impose? The electric field should have no component in the surface of the star, because the star is a conductor. Of course, in the interior of the star, the electric field should vanish if it's a solid conductor. But at the surface, where we're just imposing a boundary condition, all we can say is that the electric field components tangent to the star are zero. In fact, if you put an object like this in vacuum and just spin it, there will be a, what will happen? What will happen? Let's put vacuum here. And here's our spinning conductor. So, and it's magnetized. So in particular, consider a point here, let's say. There's a magnetic field. But a point at this latitude is going around in a circle like that. So it has a velocity in this magnetic field into the board. And V cross B then is downward. So there's going to be a force on the particle on a positive charge down this way, V cross B. So charges will flow in the conductor, and the whole sphere will become polarized by charge. And you'll get something like negative charge at the top and positive charge at the bottom. And you'll have a surface charge density. So sigma, which is a surface charge density, will develop. And that means you'll have a radial electric field component, because the electric field is zero inside, and you have a surface charge density. So surface charge gives you the jump in the electric field across an interface. So you're actually going to have a non-zero electric field outside. You can't have an electric field tangent to the sphere because it's a perfect conductor. So you're going to develop an electric field component that's parallel to B. So for example, what direction is it going to be in? I guess it doesn't look like it. It's parallel. It looks like it's perpendicular. No, I can't see what it looks like, because I have to see how the charge builds up. So I'm going to pick up negative charge here. So I'm going to have, right. I'm not sure. I think it's going to be anti-parallel here. Well, actually, I could analyze it here very easily. Yeah, OK, so it's parallel here and anti-parallel here, right? The positive charges are being pushed down, piled up, electric field goes like that, magnet. Yeah, so here E dot B is positive. And here, electric field is going to be towards this, and it's opposite. Yeah, so here E dot B is negative and non-zero. So that's what will happen. This violates the degeneracy condition on the field. So this is not a degenerate vacuum field anymore. And you have a surface charge density. And that's what would happen in vacuum. Now, if you stick this thing in a plasma or even in vacuum and you have some, except for a couple of stray charges, or if E dot B gets big enough, you could rip charges out of this sphere and accelerate them. In any case, the story with the pulsar was that this situation with a high enough angular velocity and a strong enough field is not stable, and the region around it will fill up with a plasma, a pair plasma, which will screen this electric field, which will actually kill off the surface charge density and make the field outside degenerate. And so what we're about to write down, because we're going to assume it's degenerate, we're going to write down what happens after that whole thing has taken place. But we have to be careful when we do it. Don't assume that the electric field component is perpendicular to the sphere is zero to begin with. The equation should tell us that if it's true. And because here, for instance, it's not true. That's the point I was trying to emphasize. I realize I didn't say this in the most linear way, so is there any question about what I just tried to explain? I'm also emphasizing this because when we get to a black hole spinning in a magnetic field, there's a similar process that'll be easier to understand if we've thought about this case. This would be a good homework problem for an E&M class. Calculate the electric field outside. Okay, so, but please ask if you're still puzzled by anything. So that was all, I was reminded to say all of that just because I only want to impose at the beginning that U of the conductor dot the field at the surface has no component tangent to the surface. Right? Has no component tangent to the sphere. Well, here. Now, we're going to try to find an F that satisfies this by superposing the monopole and the outgoing flux. So it's going to have the form, I'll call it F Michael. It's going to be Q sine theta d theta wedge d phi, and then where's my outgoing flux solution? Is it behind here? So for the flux, I need d of some function of the angles and u potentially wedge du. And I'm just going to write that thing as a function c du. Because I've already taken could I make that a function of, I think I'd have an integrability condition if I let that be a function of phi, having already written this here. So I'm going to make it just a function of theta and u in general. So let's now impose the boundary condition. So u of the conductor dot F Michael, it's equal to dt, it goes like dt plus omega d phi dot q. The first factor is the monopole. And this is a du wedge d of some function of theta, phi, and u.
What's d cosine theta? Because the outgoing flux requires that it be d psi wedge du, and now you have. Oh, I see. You could put that on the.
It's a special case.
I could absorb this into the. I could integrate. Yeah, that's actually why I wanted to leave out any phi dependence, because I think it would raise the problem that you were talking about. Boy, you guys are sharp. That's great. So we just have to, well, for the purpose of this boundary condition, it doesn't matter. The q sine theta doesn't matter. So I'm just going to put this tilde and drop those numbers and just write it as d theta wedge d phi plus c du. And now we just have to evaluate this contraction. So neither dt nor d by d phi has any non-zero contraction with d theta, so that doesn't contribute. So all I get here is the contraction of this vector with du, sorry, and this one with d phi. So contracting this with d phi, I just get omega, because d by d phi contracted with d phi is 1. So I get d theta times omega. And when I contract this with du, I have to remember what du is. Du is dt minus dr star. And this d by dt contracts with the dt and gives a 1. So I get plus c times 1. That's what I get. Now remember, the boundary condition is this form should have no component tangent to the sphere. But d theta is tangent to the sphere. So that means this coefficient must be 0. So that the boundary condition implies that c is negative omega. And so the actual Michael monopole is not this, but it's minus omega du. So let's put. This actually generalizes the Michael monopole. The original thing he did had a constant omega, but you see here that omega could be any function of, it could be differentially rotating at different azimuths, if that's what they're called. Anyway, different polar angles, and it could be time dependent. Okay. I think actually, historically, Blandford and Znaek noted that it could be a function of theta. And Liutikov rather recently noted that it could be a function of retarded time. It's important because physically you could describe a pulsar that has a glitch or something that changes its rotational velocity, and you still have this exact solution. Slowly, yeah. But that would be such a slow change, you probably wouldn't care about.
Observation, I'm not, but I mean, the population of pulsars, they go and look at something, not been there for a very long time. So
sure. I'm just saying, yeah. Probably more interesting, though, would be that you could model a rapid change and still have this exact solution. Okay, so that's the solution. Now let's talk about the physics of it. Like, what does it actually describe? What's going on in it? And how much energy is coming out? What's the current doing? Where's the energy coming from? And what do the field lines and field sheets look like? So that's what we'll do now.
Where's the monopole coming from? That's still a strange thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, monopole. Come on, you're so conservative. No, actually, I will say a lot about the monopole, but the first statement is simply that you can split it in half and reverse the sign of the monopole charge on the other hemisphere. Let me just say this since you brought it up. That's what a split monopole is. We slice it at the equator, flip the sign of the charge, and then we fit the two solutions together, except for now there's a mismatch on the equatorial plane where the field has flipped sign. Which means that actually there's a current sheet in the equatorial plane. Now, this sounds like a very sick and thing to do just to get rid of the monopole. You have to put up with this current sheet. But actually, the current sheet is exactly what you want, it turns out. Because if you have not a monopole star but a dipole magnetized star, it turns out it will produce a current sheet. You know, roughly the kind you get by splitting the monopole. So it's actually a surprisingly reasonable model of a dipole magnetosphere, which is more physically valid. And I'll talk about that later. So we shouldn't be worried about the fact that we're doing a monopole. Okay, let's see. I don't want to erase that yet, so I'll come over here. Let's see, it's 211. I don't think I should stop before showing you the current and the energy flux, and then we'll stop for the break. So what is the current in this solution? So J is D star F, and F is that thing I just wrote down. So we already know that the monopole piece doesn't give us any current. It's just a vacuum solution, so we can ignore everything but the second factor, the DU factor, that has a Q sine theta omega D theta wedge DU. In fact, yeah. It's D star Q sine theta D theta wedge. Oops. It's a minus Q omega sine theta D theta wedge DU, right? So first step is to do the dual and then take D of it. Again, for the dual, I'm going to write it in terms of a unit one form so I can just read off how to dualize it. This is a null one form. This is an orthogonal space-like one. So I need to find the orthogonal space-like one to this that's also orthogonal to this and has the same magnitude as this one. But that's not normalized. So let me just normalize it and rewrite it. And then I'll compute. So minus Q, I think I'll do this for a constant omega, even though we could consider the general case. So I'll pull out omega. this should be r sine theta, sorry, r d theta is the unit one. So I'm going to divide by r. And then r d theta is the same magnitude as r sine theta d phi. Well, I'm going to confuse myself and you by doing this. So let me the magnitude of r d theta is the magnitude of r sine theta d phi. So I can trade a d theta for a sine theta d phi. When I rotate to the orthogonal one form, I'm going to go from d theta to d phi. I want the magnitude to be the same, so I have to add a sine theta. That's going to make this a sine squared theta. And what am I doing with r here? Nothing. I shouldn't have put r in. So basically, I just get sine squared theta d phi wedge du. Now, it couldn't be easier to take the exterior derivative of that. I just get 2 sine theta cos theta d phi d theta. So I get minus 2 q omega sine theta cos theta d theta wedge d phi wedge du. And now for interpretation purposes, it'd be nice to write these as unit one forms. That's what I was anticipating, but I did it out of order. So here I want an r, so I'll just put an r and divide by an r. Here I want an r sine theta. I've already got my sine theta, so I'll just divide by r and put that over with that. I'd like to rewrite this as minus 2q omega over r squared r d theta wedge r sine theta d phi wedge du. And so now we can just read off, this is a null three form. It's a null one form wedge, two space-like one forms, both of which are orthogonal to it. So it's a null three form. If we were to dualize it, we'd just get a radial null vector. So the current is a radial null vector. Oh, shoot. It's important. Thank you. The current is a radial null vector. That means that the current density, that the current three vector has the same magnitude as the current density. And it falls off as 1 over r squared, both of them. That's actually kind of problematic. It means that the total charge in a solid angle, well, the sine is flipping. Cosine theta is positive in the northern hemisphere and negative in the southern. Maybe I should draw a picture of what we're getting here. So we have a negative charge density here, which is getting weaker. Positive charge density here. The current is actually, the current three vector is flowing into the northern hemisphere radially. And out of the southern hemisphere. So this is a J vector. And if we fix a solid angle, we've got one sine of the charge density all the way out to infinity, and it's only falling off like 1 over r squared. So when we multiply by r squared in the measure, we're going to get an infinite amount of charge in that solid angle. So the total charge on this thing is zero. It's neutral, but it would require an infinite amount of charges to reach to infinity. So that's definitely an unphysical aspect of it. And you'd, I mean, so in practice, the plasmon doesn't go forever, and this thing would cut off somewhere, and the return current would somehow come back to it. We shouldn't really worry about that till we split it, however, because it's a monopole, as he pointed out. If we were to split it here, we'll just flip everything on the bottom or the top. And so we could have then a current flowing in from both sides. But then we've introduced this current sheet in the equatorial plane, and that carries a current, which actually is like the return current that flows out of the sphere. And then we're not saying like somehow at infinity or out there, the circuit closes, which sources these currents that are coming in. So that's the general picture. Right. And the last point I want to make before breaking is just what's the energy flux here. So it's a stationary solution, and yet energy is flowing away from the sphere. So that's quite strange, but remember it's like a Faraday disk generator. Energy is flowing away, you can see, because the magnetic field, for instance, is radial here. Here's a B. And the electric field component is in the phi direction. Let's see, in the theta direction, sorry. So the electric field component of the two form in the rest frame of the center of symmetry here is just the form dt wedge something. To get an electric field, you need a time differential wedge something. And the only place there's a dt is here, and it's wedging with d theta. So the electric field is in the theta direction. That's orthogonal to this radial magnetic field. But it's also orthogonal to another, but this magnetic field is dropping off like 1 over r squared. That's just the monopole field. The field also has another component to the magnetic field coming from d theta wedge, the dr that's in here. And that's in the phi direction. So I don't have to draw somehow. B phi coming into the board. Oh, shoot, my diagram is labeled in an extremely confusing way. So this vector I drew here was the electric field. We have this radial monopole magnetic field, and we have a phi component of the magnetic field. So the phi component cross the E component, the E field gives us a pointing vector that's going outwards. So this actually describes a pointing flux going outwards radially everywhere. So this is in a radial outward pointing flux. In fact, pardon?
So the E cross B give you something radially, but you still got the R component as well, the radial in the theta direction.
The radial component of B?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Yes, it gives you a circulating flux, but it's falling off like 1 over r cubed because each of the, E and B phi are falling off as 1 over r, and B radial is falling off as 1 over r squared. But yeah, it has a circulating, I guess that means it has a kind of angular momentum in the field. We wrote down, I think before, the actual form of the stress tensor. It turns out it's just the magnitude of this d psi squared times the du du as a one form. So it's a null energy momentum tensor. It describes an outgoing null flux of energy. And the magnitude is just d psi squared, which goes like, remember, psi is q sine theta omega, q omega sine theta. So this goes like q squared omega squared sine squared theta. So when we integrate this over the sphere, well, I guess we get no flux at the on the axis. We integrate this over the sphere and we get some number. And it turns out the total flux is just 8 pi over 3 times this. So the total flux q squared omega squared. Yeah.
So that's the T just for the outgoing flux, but you're saying that
yes.
The monopole doesn't contain.
Well, I'm just neglecting it. It definitely has this circulating flux. So, but like I said, it's falling off as 1 over r cubed, so it doesn't like deliver any energy far from the object. Also, it's circulating, I think. So it's not energy that's being fed into the system, which is the last point I want to make before breaking. Where the heck is this energy coming from? So you actually have an energy flux away from the star. If it really were a body spinning, presumably it's the kinetic energy of that that would feed this energy, and then it would slow down. Why would it slow down? It's because there's a reaction torque in the surface of the thing. So there's going to be a surface current here flowing because positive charge is coming out here and negative charge is coming in here. There's a current flowing around the surface like that. And now, if you take the current density due to that, the surface current density, cross product with the radial magnetic field, you get a azimuthal Lorentz force pointing back in the other direction. So once the current starts to flow, it creates a back, creates a reaction force that torques in the opposite direction of the spin and would take energy out of the spin. So there's a sensible story of where the energy is coming from here. When we come to the black hole, we're not going to be able to use that reasoning because there's no surface.
What would happen in the split monopole where you replace the bottom glasses with minors?
Good question. You're still going to have
a differential?
No, it works perfectly. You reverse both the sign of the magnetic field and the sign of the current, so the sign of the reaction force is the same. See, instead of current flowing from here down to here, the current will flow to the equator from both sides. And I also have flipped the B field, so I get the same sign for the reaction.
But it would flow because you have now a gradient. It's not that you got more negative charges at the top and not positive.
Oh, right, because now I have a no surface charge density, but I still have a current.
We still have omega squared in the split monopole for the flux.
Yes. It doesn't change I think it doesn't change whatsoever the total energy. Because this is a local energy momentum tensor. So I'm just integrating this. I guess if I flipped, it doesn't change the sign of the pointing vector or its magnitude. I think there was something I'm forgetting to say here. Well, just to end now this part, this story, emphasize again, this is a rotating stationary thing, but energy is flowing out of it. Suppose we replace the monopole by a dipole magnetized star, where the dipole is lined up with the spin axis. A similar thing is going to happen. And so there's a way to extract energy from this dipole, even if it's not, it would never radiate in vacuum. If that dipole were in vacuum, nothing would happen. if it were tilted and then it was going around like that, then you have a spinning dipole and it would radiate. When I first learned about this as a postdoc from Doug Eardley, actually, I was a postdoc at Santa Barbara, and he gave an astrophysics, relativistic astro class, in which he was talking about pulsar spin down as being caused by, radiating dipole into vacuum. But here, even if it's aligned, when it wouldn't radiate into vacuum, it's still radiating. So it's interesting to compare how much radiation do you get into vacuum versus into a plasma. Of course, when it's aligned, you get nothing into vacuum. And I guess it turns out that when it's not aligned, they're comparable in magnitude for, even for maximal maximal inclination of the magnetization relative to the spin axis. So that means that the range of pulsar spin down rates or energy fluxes is much less than it would have been if it was really spinning in vacuum. Because instead of ranging from zero in the aligned case to some maximum in the perpendicular case, it's only going to range over, actually, like Luis, you probably know what the factor is. Is it a two?
1 to 2.
Factor of two. So I guess that means that this, the magnetosphere just doubles the radiation in the 100% in the 90 degree incline case.
So let's see. So you mentioned this before, but in this context, you only get a flow of energy all the way to infinity if the plasma continues all the way to infinity.
Right.
If it were to shut off, is there a conservation argument that says that you've transferred the energy so far? It will continue going in vacuum as a free electronic wave?
This is something Sam and I keep asking, and we don't know how it works. So it's a question of how do you terminate the plasma, and how does the energy transfer from there to whatever it goes to? I guess it depends on the details of the physical termination of the plasma. Like if you have the right impedance matching with the vacuum, maybe it could just convert to vacuum electromagnetic waves. Of course, the current still has to return somehow. So it's not going to be this solution because you're going to have some modification due to the different return current. And you might have some reflected energy and so forth. But here's a crucial thing. So just to tie it to what we said earlier, as it goes further and further out, it becomes more and more null. The field, because the monopole piece is falling off like 1/r². And the other piece I've been emphasizing is falling off like 1/r, the fields. But the other piece is a null bivector. So the further out you are, the more null the field is, closer to being null, which means that any particles that are in this, carried along with this, are being accelerated, and eventually, I guess probably a key part of the answer is the force-free thing breaks down. And to say what really happens there, you have to model it in a better way. But I don't know anything about it, unfortunately. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, there are methods now to do this for system MHC, but you actually can bring the resistivity down so as to make contact with vacuum. But you're using a bias, you're putting a particular model. The things will just naturally, very gradually go from the force free to the vacuum. And in such cases, the things will just keep propagating. And then you get the same energy that your engine produced here gets graduated out with.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a pretty good model.
I think it's a pretty good guess that this much energy comes out. And just the question is, what form does it end up taking? Because to get it to not come out, you'd have to have, in effect, reflected solution impinging back on the star and changing the solution at the surface of the star in such a way that you're not extracting as much energy.
Well, but on the other hand, we know that estimate what is the frequency, say in the pulsar. This is more for a pulsar. This too high a frequency. So we know that energy has been reprocessed by a whole bunch of different processes. You're putting on that energy, and that energy gets radiated.
You mean just observationally? You know that.
Well, it's interacting with whatever ambient media.
Yeah, it's a big.
And that's a big black box.
Let me emphasize what you said again, just in case anybody didn't get the point. It's the pulsar, let's say the crab is spinning 30 times per second. That's a ridiculously low frequency for electromagnetic radiation. What you see in the nebula is, you know, regular, everything from radio to, you know, very high energy gamma rays. So the energy is going into other
channel
forms.
In what sense is this supposed to model the dipole case, the split monopole?
Oh, yeah. Maybe I should start after the break by addressing that, because I think it's a good time to stop. But I'll definitely explain that. So I'll do that, and then I'll talk about the Blanford-Snyder. What happens when you basically ask the same question about a black hole? So.